Each nation has created a god, and the god has always resembled his creators. He hated and loved what they hated and loved, and he was invariably found on the side of those in power. Each god was intensely patriotic, and detested all nations but his own. All these gods demanded praise, flattery, and worship. Most of them were pleased with sacrifice, and the smell of innocent blood has ever been considered a divine perfume. All these gods have insisted upon having a vast number of priests, and the priests have always insisted upon being supported by the people. And the principal business of these priests has been to boast about their god and to insist that he could easily vanquish all the other gods put together. These gods have been manufactured after numberless models and according to the most grotesque fashions. Some have 1,000 arms, some 100 heads. Some are adorned with necklaces of living snakes. Some are armed with clubs, some with sword and shield, some with bucklers, and some have wings as a cherub. Some were invisible. Some would show themselves entire, and some would only show their backs. Some were jealous. Some are foolish. Some turned themselves into men, some into swans, some into bulls, some into doves, and some into holy ghosts, and made love to the beautiful daughters of men. Some were married. All ought to have been. And some were considered as old bachelors from all eternity. Some had children, and the children were turned into gods and worshipped as their fathers had been. Most of these gods were revengeful, savage, lustful, and ignorant. As they generally depended upon their priests for information, their ignorance can hardly excite our astonishment. These gods did not even know the shape of the worlds they had created, but supposed them perfectly flat. Some thought the day could be lengthened by stopping the sun, that the blowing of horns could throw down the walls of a city, and all knew so little of the real nature of the people they had created that they commanded the people to love them. Some were so ignorant as to suppose that man could believe just as he might desire, or as he might command, and that to be governed by observation, reason, and experience was a most foul and damning sin. These deities have demanded the most abject and degrading obedience. In order to please them, man must lay his very face in the dust. Of course, they have always been partial to the people who created them, and have generally shown their partiality by assisting those people to rob and destroy others, and to ravish their wives and daughters. Nothing is so pleasing to these gods as the butchery of unbelievers. Nothing so enrages them, even now, as to have someone deny their existence. Few nations have been so poor as to have but one god. Gods were made so easily and the raw material cost so little that generally the god market was fairly glutted and heaven crammed with these phantoms. These gods not only attended to the skies but were supposed to interfere in all the affairs of men. They presided over everybody and everything. They attended to every department. All was supposed to be under their immediate control. Nothing was too small, nothing too large. The falling of sparrows and the motions of the planets were alike attended to by these industrious and observing deities. From their starry thrones they frequently came to the earth for the purpose of imparting information to man. It's related of one that he came amidst thunderings and lightnings in order to tell the people that they should not cook a kid in its mother's milk. Some left their shining abodes to tell women that they should or should not have children, to inform a priest how to cut and wear his apron, and to give directions as to the proper manner of cleaning the intestines of a bird. When the people failed to worship one of these gods, or failed to feed and clothe his priests, which was much the same thing, he generally visited them with pestilence and famine. Sometimes he allowed some other nation to drag them into slavery, to sell their wives and children. But generally, he glutted his vengeance by murdering their firstborn. The priests always did their whole duty, not only in predicting these calamities, but in proving, when they did happen, that they were brought upon the people because they had not given quite enough to them. These gods differed just as the nations differed. The greatest and most powerful nations had the most powerful gods, while the weaker ones were obliged to content themselves with the very offscourings of the heavens. Each of these gods promised happiness here and hereafter to all of his slaves, and threatened to eternally punish all who either disbelieved in his existence or suspected that some other god might be his superior. But to deny the existence of all gods was, and is, the crime of crimes. Redden your hands with human blood, blast by slander the fair name of the innocent, strangle the smiling child upon its mother's knees, deceive, ruin, and desert the beautiful girl who loves and trusts you, and your case is not hopeless. For all this and for all these you may be forgiven. For all this and for all these that bankrupt court established by the gospel will give you a discharge. But deny the existence of these divine ghosts, of these gods, and the sweet and tearful face of mercy becomes livid with eternal hate. Heaven's golden gates are shut, and you, with an infinite curse ringing in your ears, with a brand of infamy upon your brow, commence your endless wanderings into the lurid gloom of hell, an immortal vagrant, an eternal outcast, a deathless convict. One of these gods, one who demands our love, our admiration, and our worship, and one who is worshipped, if mere heartless ceremony is worship, gave to his chosen people for their guidance the following laws of war. When thou comest nigh unto a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it. And it shall be, if it make thee an answer of peace, and opens unto thee, then it shall be that all the people that is found therein shall be tributaries unto thee, and they shall serve thee. And if it will make no peace with thee, but will make war against thee, then thou shalt besiege it. And when the Lord thy God hath delivered it into thy hands, thou shalt smite every male thereof with the edge of the sword. But the women, and the little ones, and the cattle, and all that is in the city, even all the spoil thereof, shalt thou take unto thyself. And thou shalt eat the spoil of thine enemies, which the Lord thy God hath given thee. Thus shalt thou do unto all the cities which are very far off from thee, which are not of the cities of these nations. But of the cities of these people which the Lord thy God doth give thee for an inheritance, thou shalt save alive nothing that breatheth. Is it possible for man to conceive of anything more perfectly infamous? Can you believe that such directions were given by any being except an infinite fiend? Remember that the army receiving these instructions was one of invasion. Peace was offered upon condition that the people submitting should be the slaves of the invader. But if any should have the courage to defend their homes, to fight for the love of wife and child, then the sword was to spare none, not even the prattling, dimpled babe. And we are called upon to worship such a God, to get upon our knees and to tell him that he is good, that he is merciful, that he is just, that he is love. We're asked to stifle every noble sentiment of the soul and to trample underfoot all the sweet charities of the heart. Because we refuse to stultify ourselves, refuse to become liars, we are denounced, hated, traduced, and ostracized here. And the same God threatens to torment us in eternal fire the moment death allows him to fiercely clutch our naked, helpless souls. Well, let the people hate. Let the God threaten. We will educate them, and we will despise and defy the God. The book called the Bible is filled with passages equally horrible, unjust, and atrocious. This is a book to be read in schools in order to make our children loving, kind, and gentle. This is a book they wish to be recognized in our Constitution as a source of all authority and justice. We're asked to justify these frightful passages, these infamous laws of war, because the Bible is the Word of God. As a matter of fact, there never was and there never can be an argument even tending to prove the inspiration of any book whatever. In the absence of positive evidence, analogy, and experience, argument is simply impossible, and at the very best can amount only to a useless agitation of the air. The instant we admit that a book is too sacred to be doubted or even reasoned about, we are mental serfs. It is infinitely absurd to suppose that a God would address a communication to intelligent beings and yet make it a crime to be punished in eternal flames for them to use their intelligence for the purpose of understanding his communication. If we have the right to use our reason, we certainly have the right to act in accordance with it, and no God can have the right to punish us for such action. The doctrine that future happiness depends upon belief is monstrous. It is the infamy of infamies. The notion that faith in Christ is to be rewarded by an eternity of bliss, while a dependence upon reason, observation, and experience merits everlasting pain, is too absurd for refutation, and can be relieved only by that unhappy mixture of insanity and ignorance called faith. What man who ever thinks can believe that blood can appease God? And yet, our entire system of religion is based upon that belief. The Jews pacified Jehovah with the blood of animals, and according to the Christian system, the blood of Jesus softened the heart of God a little, and rendered possible the salvation of a fortunate few. It is hard to conceive how the human mind can give assent to such terrible ideas. or how any sane man can read the Bible and still believe in the doctrine of inspiration. Whether the Bible is true or false is of no consequence in comparison with the mental freedom of the race. Salvation through slavery is worthless. Salvation from slavery is inestimable. As long as man believes the Bible to be infallible, that book is his master. The civilization of this century is not the child of faith, but of unbelief, the result of free thought. All that is necessary, as it seems to me, to convince any reasonable person that the Bible is simply and purely of human invention, a barbarian invention, is to read it. Read it as you would any other book. Think of it as you would of any other. Get the bandage of reverence from your eyes. Drive from your heart the phantom of fear. Push from the throne of your brain the coiled form of superstition. And then read the Holy Bible. And you will be amazed that you ever, for one moment, supposed a being of infinite wisdom, goodness, and purity to be the author of such ignorance and of such atrocity. Our ancestors not only had their god factories, but they made devils as well. These devils were generally disgraced and fallen gods. Some had headed unsuccessful revolts. Some had been caught sweetly reclining in the shadowy folds of some fleecy cloud, kissing the wife of the god of gods. These devils generally sympathize with man. There is in regard to them a most wonderful fact. In nearly all the theologies, mythologies, and religions, the devils have been much more humane and merciful than the gods. No devil ever gave one of his generals an order to kill children and to rip open the bodies of pregnant women. Such barbarities were always ordered by the good gods. The pestilences were sent by the most merciful gods. The frightful famine, during which the dying child with pallid lips sucked the withered bosom of a dead mother, was sent by the loving gods. No devil was ever charged with such fiendish brutality. One of these gods, according to the account, drowned an entire world with the exception of 8 persons. The old, the young, the beautiful, and the helpless were remorselessly devoured by a shoreless sea. This, the most fearful tragedy that the imagination of ignorant priests ever conceived, was the act not of a devil, but of a god, so called, whom men ignorantly worship unto this day. What a stain such an act would leave upon the character of a devil! One of the prophets of one of these gods, having in his power a captured king, hewed him in pieces in the sight of all the people. Was ever any imp or any devil guilty of such savagery? Some nations have borrowed their gods. Of this number we are compelled to say is our own. The Jews, having ceased to exist as a nation, and having no further use for a god, our ancestors appropriated him and adopted their devil at the same time. This borrowed god is still an object of some adoration, and this adopted devil still excites the apprehensions of our people. He is still supposed to be setting his traps and snares for the purpose of catching our unwary souls, and is still, with reasonable success, waging the old war against our God. To me, it seems easy to account for these ideas concerning gods and devils. They're a perfectly natural production. Man has created them all, and under the same circumstances would create them again. Man has not only created all of these gods, but he has created them out of the very materials by which he has been surrounded. Generally, he's modeled them after himself, and has given them hands, heads, feet, eyes, ears, and organs of speech. Each nation made its gods and devils not only speak its language, but put in their mouths the same mistakes in history, geography, astronomy, and in all matters of fact generally made by the people. No god was ever in advance of the nation that created him. The Negroes represented their deities with black skins and curly hair. The Mongolian gave to his a yellow complexion and dark almond-shaped eyes. The Jews were not allowed to paint theirs, or we should have seen Jehovah with a full beard, an oval face, and an aquiline nose. Zeus was a perfect Greek, and Jove looked as though a member of the Roman Senate. Nearly all people have carved or painted representations of their gods, and these representations were, by the lower classes, generally treated as the real gods. And to these images and idols they addressed prayers and offered sacrifices. In some countries, even at this day, if the people after long praying do not obtain their desires, they turn their images off as impotent gods, or upbraid them in a most reproachful manner, loading them with blows and curses. "How now, dog of a spirit," they say, "we give you lodging in a magnificent temple, We gild you with gold, feed you with the choicest foods, and offer incense to you. And yet after all this care, you are so ungrateful as to refuse us what we ask." Hereupon they will pull the god down and drag him through the filth of the street. Now if in the meantime it happens that they obtain their request, then with a great deal of ceremony they wash him clean, carry him back and place him in his temple again, whereupon they fall down and make excuses for what they have done. "No, of a truth," they say, "we were a little too hasty, but you were a little too long in your grant. Why should you bring this beating on yourself?" "Ah, but what is done cannot be undone. Let us not think of it any more. If you will forget what has passed, we will gild you over brighter again than before." Nothing can be plainer than that each nation gives to its goddess peculiar characteristics, and that every individual gives to his goddess personal peculiarities. Man has no ideas and can have none, except those suggested by his surroundings. He cannot conceive of anything utterly unlike what he has seen or felt. He can exaggerate, diminish, combine, separate, deform, beautify, improve, multiply, and compare what he sees, what he feels, what he hears, and all of which he takes cognizance of through the medium of the senses, but he cannot create. Having seen exhibitions of power, he can say omnipotent. Having lived, he can say immortality. Knowing something of time, he can say eternity. Conceiving something of intelligence, he can say God. Having seen exhibitions of malice, he can say devil. A few gleams of happiness having fallen athwart the gloom of his life, he can say heaven. Pain, in its numberless forms, having been experienced, he can say hell. Yet all these ideas have a foundation in fact, but only a foundation. The superstructure has been reared by exaggerating, diminishing, combining, separating, deforming, beautifying, improving, or multiplying realities, so that the edifice or fabric is but the incongruous groupings of what man has perceived through the medium of the senses. It is as though we should give to a lion the wings of an eagle, the hooves of a bison, the tail of a horse, the pouch of a kangaroo, and the trunk of an elephant. We have in imagination created an impossible monster, and yet the various parts of this monster really exist. So it is with all the gods that man has made. Beyond nature man cannot go even in thought. Above nature he cannot rise, below nature he cannot fall. Man in his ignorance supposed that all phenomena were produced by some intelligent powers, and with direct reference to him. To preserve friendly relations with these powers was, and still is, the object of all religions. Man knelt through fear and to implore assistance, or in gratitude for some favor which he supposed to have been rendered. He endeavored by supplication to appease some being who, for some reason, had, as he believed, become enraged. The lightning and thunder terrified him. In the presence of the volcano he sank upon his knees. The great forest filled with wild and ferocious beasts, the monstrous serpents crawling in mysterious depths, the boundless sea, the flaming comets, the sinister eclipses, the awful calmness of the stars, and, more than all, the perpetual presence of death, convinced him that he was the sport and prey of unseen and malignant powers. The strange and frightful diseases to which he was subject, the freezing and burnings of fever, the contortions of epilepsy, the sudden palsies, the darkness of night, and the wild, terrible, and fantastic dreams that filled his brain, satisfied him that he was haunted and pursued by countless spirits of evil. For some reason he supposed that these spirits differed in power, that they were not all alike malevolent, that the higher controlled the lower, and that his very existence depended upon gaining the assistance of the more powerful. For this purpose he resorted to prayer, to flattery, to worship, and to sacrifice. These ideas appear to have been almost universal in savage man. For all ages, nations supposed that the sick and insane were possessed by evil spirits. For thousands of years, the practice of medicine consisted in frightening these spirits away. Usually the priests would make the loudest and most discordant noises possible. They would blow horns, beat upon rude drums, clash cymbals, and in the meantime utter the most unearthly yells. If the noise remedy failed, they would implore the aid of some more powerful spirit. To pacify these spirits was considered of infinite importance. The poor barbarian, knowing that men could be softened by gifts, gave to these spirits that which to him seemed of the most value. With bursting heart he would offer the blood of his dearest child. It was impossible for him to conceive of a god utterly unlike himself, and he naturally supposed that these powers of the air would be affected a little at the sight of so great and so deep a sorrow. It was with the barbarian then as with the civilized now. One class lived upon and made merchandise of the fears of another. Certain persons took it upon themselves to appease the gods and to instruct the people in their duties to these unseen powers. This was the origin of the priesthood. The priest pretended to stand between the wrath of the gods and the helplessness of man. He was man's attorney at the court of heaven. He carried into the invisible world a flag of truce, a protest, and a request. He came back with a command, with authority, and with power. Man fell upon his knees before his own servant, and the priest, taking advantage of the awe inspired by his supposed influence with the gods, made of his fellow man a cringing hypocrite and a slave. Even Christ, the supposed Son of God, taught that persons were possessed of evil spirits, and frequently, according to the account, gave proof of his divine origin and mission by frightening droves of devils out of his unfortunate countrymen. Casting out devils was his principal employment, and the devils thus banished generally took occasion to acknowledge him as a true Messiah, which was not only very kind of them, but quite fortunate for him. The religious people have always regarded the testimony of these devils as perfectly conclusive, and the writers of the New Testament quote the words of these imps of darkness with great satisfaction. The fact that Christ could withstand the temptations of the devil was considered as conclusive evidence that he was assisted by some god, or at least by some being superior to man. St. Matthew gives an account of an attempt made by the devil to tempt the supposed Son of God, and it has always excited the wonder of Christians that the temptation was so nobly and heroically withstood. The account to which I refer is as follows. Then was Jesus led up of the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil. And when the tempter came to him, he said, If thou be the Son of God, command that these stones be made bread. But he answered and said, It is written, Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. Then the devil taketh him up into the holy city, and setteth him upon a pinnacle of the temple, and saith unto him, If thou be the Son of God, cast thyself down. For it is written, He shall give his angels charge concerning thee, lest at any time thou shalt dash thy foot against a stone. Jesus said unto him, It is written again, Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. Again the devil taketh him up into an exceeding high mountain, and sheweth him all the kingdoms of the world, and the glory of them, and saith unto him, All these will I give thee, if thou wilt fall down and worship me. Well, the Christians now claim that Jesus was God. If he was God, of course the devil knew that fact, and yet, according to this account, the devil took the omnipotent God and placed him upon a pinnacle of the temple and endeavored to induce him to dash himself against the earth. And failing in that, he took the creator, owner, and governor of the universe up into an exceeding high mountain and offered him this world, this grain of sand, if he, the God of all the worlds, would fall down and worship him, a poor devil, without even a tax title to 1 foot of dirt. Is it possible the devil was such an idiot? Should any great credit be given to this deity for not being caught with such chaff? Think of it. The devil, the prince of sharpers, the king of cunning, the master of finesse, trying to bribe God with a grain of sand that belonged to God. Is there in all the religious literature of the world anything more grossly absurd than this? In the olden times, the existence of devils was universally admitted. The people had no doubt upon that subject, and from such belief it followed, as a matter of course, that a person, in order to vanquish these devils, had either to be a god or to be assisted by one. All founders of religions have established their claims to divine origin by controlling evil spirits and by suspending the laws of nature. Casting out devils was a certificate of divinity. A prophet unable to cope with the powers of darkness was regarded with contempt. The utterance of the highest and noblest sentiments, the most blameless and holy life, commanded but little respect unless accompanied by power to work miracles and to command spirits. This belief in good and evil powers had its origin in the fact that man was surrounded by what he was pleased to call good and evil phenomena. Phenomena affecting man pleasantly were ascribed to good spirits, while those affecting him unpleasantly or injuriously were ascribed to evil spirits. It being admitted that all phenomena were produced by spirits, the spirits were divided according to the phenomena, and the phenomena were good or bad as they affected man. Good spirits were supposed to be the authors of good phenomena, and evil spirits of the evil. So that the idea of a devil has been as universal as the idea of a god. The foolish doctrine that all phenomena can be traced to the interference of good and evil spirits has been, and still is, almost universal. That most people still believe in some spirit that can change the natural order of events is proven by the fact that nearly all resort to prayer. Thousands at this very moment are probably imploring some supposed power to interfere in their behalf. Some want health restored. Some ask that the loved and absent be watched over and protected. Some pray for riches. Some for rain. Some want diseases stayed. Some vainly ask for food. Some ask for revivals. A few ask for more wisdom, and now and then one tells the Lord to do as he may think best. Thousands ask to be protected from the devil. Some, like David, pray for revenge. And some implore even God not to lead them into temptation. All these prayers rest upon and are produced by the idea that some power not only can, but probably will, change the order of the universe. This belief has been among the great majority of tribes and nations. All sacred books are filled with the accounts of such interferences, and our own Bible is no exception to this rule. If we believe in a power superior to nature, it is perfectly natural to suppose that such power can and will interfere in the affairs of this world. If there is no interference, of what practical use can such power be? The Scriptures give us the most wonderful accounts of divine interference. Animals talk like men. Springs gurgle from dry bones. The sun and moon stop in the heavens in order that General Joshua may have more time to murder. The shadow on a dial goes back 10 degrees to convince a petty king of a barbarous people that he is not going to die of a boil. Fire refuses to burn. Water positively declines to seek its level, but stands up like a wall. Grains of sand become lice. Common walking sticks, to gratify a mere freak, twist themselves into serpents and then swallow each other. The veil between heaven and earth was always rent or lifted. The shadows of this world, the radiance of heaven, and the glare of hell mixed and mingled until man became uncertain as to which country he really inhabited. Man dwelt in an unreal world. He mistook his ideas, his dreams, for real things. His fears became terrible and malicious monsters. He lived in the midst of furies and fairies, nymphs and maids, goblins and ghosts, witches and wizards, spirits and spooks, deities and devils. The obscure and gloomy depths were filled with claw and wing, with beak and hoof, with leering looks and sneering mouths, with the malice of deformity, with the cunning of hatred, and with all the slimy forms that fear can draw and paint upon the shadowy canvas of the dark. It is enough to make one almost insane with pity to think what man in the long night has suffered, of the tortures he has endured, surrounded, as he supposed, by malignant powers and clutched by the fierce phantoms of the air. No wonder that he fell upon his trembling knees, that he built altars and reddened them even with his own blood. No wonder that he implored ignorant priests and impudent magicians for aid. No wonder that he crawled groveling in the dust to the temple's door, and there, in the insanity of despair, besought the deaf gods to hear his bitter cry of agony and fear. The savage, as he emerges from a state of barbarism, gradually loses faith in his idols of wood and stone, and in their place puts a multitude of spirits. As he advances in knowledge, he generally discards the petty spirits, and in their stead believes in one, whom he supposes to be infinite and supreme. Supposing this great spirit to be superior to nature, he offers worship or flattery in exchange for assistance. At last, finding that he obtains no aid from this supposed deity, finding that every search after the absolute must of necessity end in failure, finding that man cannot by any possibility conceive of the conditionless, he begins to investigate the facts by which he is surrounded and to depend upon himself. The people are beginning to think, to reason, and to investigate. Slowly, painfully, but surely, the gods are being driven from the earth. Only upon rare occasions are they, even by the most religious, supposed to interfere in the affairs of men. In most matters, we are at last supposed to be free. Since the invention of steamships and railways, so that the products of all countries can be easily interchanged, the gods have quit the business of producing famine. Now and then they kill a child because it's idolized by his parents, but as a rule they've given up causing accidents on railroads, exploding boilers, and bursting kerosene lamps. Cholera, yellow fever, and smallpox are still considered heavenly weapons, but measles, itch, and ague are now attributed to natural causes. As a general thing, the gods have stopped drowning children, except as punishment for violating the Sabbath. They still pay some attention to the affairs of kings, men of genius, and persons of great wealth, but ordinary people are left to shirk for themselves as best they may. In wars between great nations, the gods still interfere. But in prize fights, the best man with an honest referee is almost sure to win. The church cannot abandon the idea of special providence. To give up that doctrine is to give up all. The church must insist that prayer is answered, that some power superior to nature hears and grants the requests of the sincere and humble Christian, and that this same power in some mysterious way provides for all. A devout clergyman sought every opportunity to impress upon the mind of his son the fact that God takes care of all of his creatures, that the falling sparrow attracts his attention, and that his loving kindness is over all his works. Happening one day to see a crane waiting in quest of food, the good man pointed out to his son the perfect adaptation of the crane to get his living in this manner. "See," said he, "how his legs are formed for waiting. What a long, slender bill he has. Observe how nicely he folds his feet when putting them in or drawing them out of the water. He does not cause the slightest ripple. He is thus enabled to approach the fish without giving them any notice of his arrival." "My son," said he, "it is impossible to look at that bird without recognizing the design, as well as the goodness of God, in thus providing the means of subsistence." "Yes," replied the boy, "I think I see the goodness of God, at least so far as the crane is concerned. But, father, don't you think the arrangement a little tough on the fish?"